I had Joseph Farrell on the show, Coast to Coast show, a couple of years ago to talk about the Nazi Bell, and I still get comments about that program. No one really knew him, at least in our audience, was familiar with his work, but man, he follows research wherever it leads, and he goes into some very interesting areas. Now he has turned his keen eye on the banking industry. His new book is called Babylon's Banksters, and we'll be jumping right into it with Joseph Farrell right after this. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph Farrell has a doctorate from the University of Oxford. He's pursued research in physics, alternative history, and science, and in his words, some strange stuff. His first book, The Giza Death Star, came out in 2002, and he's followed it up with some excellent work since then. I don't know, Joseph, do you crank out a book a year? Is that what you're doing?
I try and do about two a year, actually. So we've got to keep the food on the table.
Wow. Yeah, I'd say, I don't know if you heard the introduction, but I still get comments about the interview we did with you about the Nazi Bell. It really struck a
Oh,
nerve. So I'm reading the book now. I haven't finished it because it's a load. It's a lot to get your mind around.
yeah.
Give me the general premise, how you tie in bankers or banksters with physics, high finance, and ancient religion, the general sort of your general theme, and then we'll jump into some specifics.
Well, basically, George, my theme in the book has been to try and show that there has been a consistent pattern exhibited by what we would call the international bankers, or I like to call them banksters because I think they're in kind of a racketeering business. But the basic premise is that there are two different ways to approach physics and finance. And the first way is to approach them as closed systems. In other words, systems based on scarce energy, scarce resources, and therefore scarce money. And then the second system is to approach both systems as open systems where energy is in abundant supply, if you just know how to tap into it, and where money in turn reflects this by being the creation of the state and therefore a debt-free instrument of exchange. So I'm attempting to tie those two basic concepts together and then to show kind of a consistent pattern of activity on the fact of these banksters doing certain things in modern times. And then I use that as kind of a template to go back and look at ancient times and see pretty much the same activity.
So your basic contention is that what's unfolded now is not an aberration, that
No.
it's the result of centuries of activity by the same players, basically.
Yes, essentially that's correct. The book really moves between the modern period and the very ancient one. I don't really fill in the medieval period other than very, very briefly. You know, if I had done this as a thorough scholarly study, then the book would have been several books. So I just decided to kind of give a very high overview of the subject.
All right, well, help me understand the link to alchemy.
Well, alchemy—that's an excellent question. Alchemy is, of course, the science of, or pseudoscience, depending upon one's lights, of transmuting base metals into gold. But the further you dig back into alchemical texts, the more apparent it becomes that what they're really talking about is a physics of the physics of the physical medium, in other words, of space-time. And it's that medium itself that creates information. It creates everything that exists and transmutes itself, essentially. So alchemy, viewed in that sense, from that physics approach, is kind of a transmutational physics. Now, the tie-in with finance is that money, if you look at it, the two philosophies of money, if you look at it is a kind of an alchemy in itself. You're taking something and transmuting it into a medium of exchange and then using it to buy goods and services. And there's two kinds, as far as I'm concerned, there's two kinds of alchemy that are in evidence. One is, of course, is the system that we've been living under, where you have a private banking monopoly issuing monetized debt. In other words, the money always carries an interest-bearing load on it. And so it's always going to be money that's in shorter supply than the demands of the economic system that it's in. The other kind is kind of a true alchemy, where you're basing it on the productive output of a given state, and that ties very directly into the physics of the zero point energy, where you're dealing with an energy that's constantly productive. So again, you know, we're back to those, that basic idea that we're dealing with two different kinds of systems, a closed system physics and a closed system financial system, and an open system physics and an open system financial system.
Take us back to the beginning, as far back as you can go, that sort of ties into what we see happening now.
Well,
how far back?
That's a loaded question,
Well, of course it is.
Yeah, it really opens up the Pandora's box. If you go back all the way back to ancient Sumer and Akkad and the Mesopotamian region, the very earliest form of money was, of course, state-issued money. In other words, it was issued debt-free, and essentially what they used as money were nothing but cuneiform tablets, little clay tablets, that were basically orders on the surpluses of the state warehouse. In other words, if we were to put it into modern terms, it would be a note or a paper note that would be circulated against the gross domestic product of the United States. In other words, it would be debt-free. Now, over time, what happened was the issuing authority in those ancient cultures ultimately became entangled with the temple. In other words, it was religion that sort of gave money its sanctity and its probity. And one of the things that begins to happen is, as these various cultures trade with each other, is you see the rise of an international mercantile class that then begins to specialize in bullion, in the issuance of bullion. And what they do is they ally themselves with the temple. In other words, they get the probity of the temple and of religion. And then they begin to, quite frankly, to counterfeit the state-issued notes, because it's the temples that have control over the minting back then. So they begin to counterfeit through the temple and issue state-issued notes that are really beyond the authority or the authorization of the state, and they collapse the currency. And then they step in and say, well, why don't we use bullion as a basis or a medium of exchange? And that will be able to better handle international traffic. But, of course, they're the ones that control the bullion trade. So in essence, what you get down to is you get down to the circulation of an interest-bearing note, because they control the bullion trade, and they gradually substitute that kind of monetized debt for the circulating issues of the state, and eventually they take those issues out of circulation. So again, if you want to draw the modern parallel, you can go back and think of President Kennedy and his issuance of those United States notes. I remember as a kid even spending some of those.
Or maybe even more direct is the Wall Street bankers who are bundling together mortgages,
yes,
debt, in essence, and selling debt as a product.
Yes, exactly so. Exactly so. Well, that's all the Federal Reserve note is. It's just simply monetized debt. Because, of course, you know, the basic lesson that people have to learn is that any bank, including the Federal Reserve, can never issue interest. They can only lend money into circulation. And any time money is lent, it, of course, carries interest. So there's never enough money in circulation to pay the interest on the principal. A state, on the other hand, can not only lend money into circulation, but it can issue money. So when it issues money, it issues it debt-free. Well, you know, I remember spending those Kennedy United States notes with the red seal on them as a kid. But what the Federal Reserve did is anytime it received those notes in its transactions, it simply took them out of circulation. And this is, again, this is a very, very old ploy that the banksters have used going back millennia.
Give me some examples for our listeners of where this has manifested itself in history. Names, I'm guessing that you're saying it's basically in every culture,
yes,
throughout recorded history, at least through most of civilization. Give us some examples of how it pops up, examples that maybe we would recognize or that might ring a bell.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of them would be the currency, National Currency Act, shortly after the Civil War. I believe it was shortly after. It may have been toward the very end of the Civil War, when, of course, President Lincoln was issuing debt-free money, the greenbacks, in order to fund the Northern effort during the Civil War. That would be one famous example. The other example I would point to where state-issued money has been instituted would be Nazi Germany. But prior to that, I'd point out that that hyperinflation that the Weimar Republic experienced. It was not the German government that was hyperinflating its currency, because again, the Reichsbank was essentially a private bank. So it was basically hyperinflating its own currency and crashing, crashing the German economy to boot. So there's any number of examples. The other example I'd point out, that we've had this conflict between state-issued money and then a private monopoly-issued money, goes back to pre-Revolutionary War period in this country, when most of the colonies were issuing their own colonial money, colonial scrip, and doing so more or less debt-free. And that accounted for the full employment that we had for a certain period of time before the Revolutionary War. It accounted for the colonial prosperity. And, of course, the Bank of England stepped in and forced Parliament to pass certain laws and shut that activity down. And, of course, the effect was instant. It crashed many colonial economies and eventually contributed a significant cause to the Revolutionary War. So, you know, those are just but a few examples.
And are we talking about something, is it fair to characterize this as some sort of an international cabal or cabals plural?
I think so. And the reason why is, and it's a very interesting question, because when you go back into ancient history and see the activity of these early versions of international bankers, I like to call them bullion brokers. It's not actually my term, it's another researcher's term. But when you see their activity, the most interesting thing that you see is a kind of a coordinated policy between the Orient and the Occident, namely India and China on the one hand, and the Roman Empire and some of these other ancient civilizations in the Occident on the other. Because you find Rome, for example, artificially making gold the bullion of choice vis-a-vis other bullions. But when you go to the Orient, you find the exact opposite policy. You find them making silver the most valued bullion. So what this does, in effect, is it enhances the power of these bullion brokers to trade between the Orient and the Occident back and forth. And the most interesting example of that to me, George, is there is a famous set of mines in ancient Egypt back in those times called the Bishari Mines. And there's a classical Roman author by the name of Diodorus Siculus that even comments on these mines. Well, this is where, of course, the pharaohs would sentence people to work the gold mines of Bishari. But the most interesting thing, George, is that the people there were guarded by an international contingent of mercenaries and of several languages. So in other words, the whole operation really requires some sort of international coordination even to be able to get that kind of operation in place. So you've got these two things, I think, that argue for an existence of this international class from very, very ancient times.
And how does it work? I mean, is there a secret handshake? Are the secret ways of manipulating the world handed down generation to generation, banker to banker?
Well, I would believe so. You know, it really is an interesting question, and it's not far off, you know, to imagine a secret handshake, because again, if we go back to the fact that this class of people is for so many centuries associated with the activity of the temple, with religion, in other words, and with astrology and so on and so forth, which is another interesting connection. But if we look at that consistent association of these people all the way from ancient Greece into Mesopotamia, to Rome, to the Orient, it's very, very clear that there is some sort of hidden elite that is binding them all together and coordinating some of this activity. So, yes, I'd have to say so.
What's your name for it?
Well, that's another good question. At this point, I really don't know if it has a name. I just simply call them the bullion brokers. But if we were to look at some of the ancient mystery schools, I think you'd have to give credit to some things like the Neoplatonists, the Gnostics, and so on and so forth, all the Hermetic movements that come out of ancient Egypt. But do they have a name, or did they have a name? If they did for themselves, they haven't told us what it is.
Well, I just think about, you know, the stories you hear over the years about the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and people with modern banking connections, and their names always linked to international cabals and New World Order, things of that sort. Are we far off the mark from that?
No, I don't think we are. One of the things I point out, at least in ancient times, is as the power of this group of people grows, you find them funding or coordinating the activities of ever larger empires. And the other thing, interestingly enough, that they're involved in is they're involved in the coordination of religious activity into ever more comprehensive sorts of pantheons, and then ultimately, I think, monotheism as well. So I think, yeah, you're dealing with the same sort of coordinated activity in ancient times that you're looking at today with the, you know, people like the Rockefeller family coordinating things like the Council on Foreign Relations and being heavy investors in religious activities like the World Council of Churches and so on and so forth. So, yes, I think there's a consistent template of action on the part of these people.
And the connection to religious organizations, is that a control mechanism?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Feed it to the public kind of a thing?
Yeah, not only that, I think also we have to allow for the possibility that since religion is such a cohesive and culture-creating factor, that the other thing they're attempting to do is manipulate the client of opinion in certain instances. And I think, although I don't go into this particular part of the activity in Babylon's Banksters, I'm writing a book right now where I talk about some of it, but I think if you look back at ancient times, you certainly have to grant that as well as a possibility that these people are involved with.
And we're not saying that religion, it's not an attack on religion or that religion is made up or not true. It's that these people you're talking about have been able to manipulate it and put it to use.
Yeah, they are manipulating it. In some cases, they are manipulating its doctrines, they're manipulating its texts, but they're certainly not, in a sense, creating it in that sense. But the other point that I want to underscore here again is that, and I do get into this a bit in Babylon's Banksters, they are trying to create ever more coordinated pantheons, they're trying to create ever more and larger empires, and eventually I think that you find their hand really involved in some of the creation of monotheistic doctrine. So, and that's something that I don't get into in Babylon's Banksters. I'm planning to explore it more in the book I'm writing now.
And of course, there are connections to governments through the centuries.
Oh, yes,
but this what you're talking about transcends governments. It's as if that they use governments when it's convenient, but discard them when it's not.
Exactly. And that's an important point to recognize, because these people have no hesitation. If a government policy is against their policy, they have no hesitation in creating wars, internal strife, dissensions, assassinations, and so on to get rid of a government that's not following their monetized debt policy. Absolutely.
And you're saying they've done that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind that we have a consistent pattern in this country alone of the activity of these banksters in suppressing any move to state-created money. The Revolutionary War is an example of that. After the Revolutionary War, when they do begin to monetize the debt very slightly, you have another example of it. The assassination of President Lincoln, in my opinion, is unquestionably tied to his financial policy and how it upset the banksters. There's no end of this. President Garfield, of course, President Kennedy, you know, any president that's come along and said, you know, we ought to examine this financial policy, peculiarly ends up dead.
Well, that's amazing, because, you know, mainstream historical research you don't see the bankers as being behind either of any of those acts.
Oh, of course not, you know, but this brings up another little problem. You know, you have the American Historical Society and some of these other so-called professional unions that are basically funded by some of these large banks and corporations to push a particular point of view. I mean, I was a college professor, I dealt with this all the time. So, yeah, they are active in the creation of a climate of opinion and pushing it and active in taking out anybody that does not follow their monetized debt policy. There's no question in my mind. This is a consistent thing that's been going on since ancient times.
Well, I would think you'd be high on their list.
Well, I hope not. You know.
My guest is Joseph Farrell. We're talking about Babylon's Banksters. When we come back, I want to dive into the examples he gave, the JFK and Lincoln assassinations, and see what evidence there is to show a link to the banking industry. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Joseph Farrell, author of the new book, Babylon's Banksters. And right before the break, he said something fairly intriguing, saying that it's unquestioned in his mind that bankers, the banking industry, the cabal, had something to do with the Lincoln assassination and also JFK. We'll get into that and more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph Farrell, you said there's no question in your mind that bankers had something to do with the assassination of Lincoln. What's the evidence?
Well, it actually comes from two different sources, George. One of them is an article that appeared in 1864 in the London Times. It was kind of an op-ed piece by Lord Rothschild. And he lamented the fact that Lincoln was funding or financing the Civil War by issuing these debt-free greenbacks. And he called it an aberration, and it had to be dealt with. In other words, it had to be put an end to. But the other interesting thing I ran into was a comment by Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, who, of course, was a contemporary of Lincoln, and he wrote or stated in 1866, I believe it was, that there was no doubt in his mind that the high financial powers of Europe had had a hand in the assassination of President Lincoln precisely because of his financial policy. Well, you know, considering the source, you know, that it's coming from here, you know, the Chancellor of Prussia, this is a man that's rather well connected to those high financial powers. And for him to say something like that and say it on the record to me is pretty persuasive. But again, Lincoln fits into a consistent pattern. And I think we have to look at the pattern of the activity of these bankers, because again, Kennedy himself decided that he would issue a certain amount, I think it was $4 billion worth of debt-free notes. And 6 months later, of course, he ends up dead in Dallas. President Garfield said something similar to both men, and he ended up dead only 3 months into his presidency. So I think we're looking, you know, one time is maybe coincidence, but three times I think we're looking pretty much at a pattern here. So, yeah, these bankers have spared no effort in getting certain nations to adopt their fiscal policy.
So if the bankers can take out a national leader like a president, I suppose they can also build one up.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Examples of that?
Well, I think you have to look really at the high level of influence that the Rockefeller-backed Council on Foreign Relations has had in the American presidency, at least since its founding in the 1920s, and particularly so after World War II. I mean, my word, it's kind of a revolving door between government and private industry with cabinet appointments and lesser cabinet appointments. It's really, really been kind of a circus. And to me, the real election that kind of spelled it all for me, George, was 2004, when you had George Bush and John Kerry, you know, both insiders running for essentially the same group of people.
And nothing against these two fine educational institutions, but it's like all those guys come from either Harvard or Yale. It's
yes.
Like, oh, yeah, well, we're very egalitarian. We'll accept anybody in this revolving door as long as it's Harvard or Yale.
Yes, exactly so. Well, that's, you know, I think that's pretty much where they do their recruiting for these political candidates. But
when I asked about building someone up, I was wondering about Hitler, and I haven't got that far in your book, or I'm not even sure if you mentioned Hitler in there, but I wonder, did the bankers play a role in his rise?
Well, that's another excellent question. I don't talk in Babylon's Banksters, believe it or not, about the build-up or the role of Wall Street in financing Hitler. I've talked about that in some of my other books. I only mention it very briefly in Babylon's Banksters. But the interesting thing is, not only did Wall Street play a significant role in bankrolling the Nazi Party in some of its election campaigns, but the interesting thing is that Hitler, once he took power, turned on those backers, because very quickly he made the connection. Nazi Germany is an interesting state in this regard, to make the connection between open system physics and open system finance, because, of course, they did establish those departments of the SS to investigate so-called zero-point energy. And at the same time, nearly the same time that they did that, Hitler had the state itself issue what were called labor treasury certificates, and these things essentially circulated like money inside of Nazi Germany. But because they were issued by the state, they were essentially debt-free. So he entirely bypassed the Reichsbank and went back to a state-issued monetary system. So in a certain sense, you know, I'm not trying to justify the crimes of the Nazi regime by any stretch of the imagination, but in a certain sense, at this point, the bankers had to take Germany out. Because if that doctrine had spread to other countries, of course, there would have been prosperity galore, and they would not have ended up at the top of the heap. I mean, my word, right now, you know, 10 years ago, there was approximately something like 17% of the wealth of the country was in the hands of the bankers. Now it's almost 60%. So, you know, we're looking right down the barrel of the gun, and we've got to do something.
Well, we'll certainly get into that through the course of the evening. Back to the Hitler example. So sure. you're saying that he and again, we're in agreement that there are a lot of reasons for the world to go to war with Hitler and take him out. But you're saying that the bankers played a role in goading that on?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind that they did. There's no doubt in my mind that they did, because once Hitler had made this decision and put Germany back on the track to a state-issued money, what did you have happen? You had the call for international boycotts and so on and so forth. And of course, there was certainly moral reason to do that with the persecution of the Jews. But the other reason that they did it was, of course, to try and inhibit Germany's international trade. Well, that didn't work too well, because what the Nazis then did is they shifted to a system of international barter, and particularly did that inside of Eastern Europe. So they kind of did an end run around the attempt of the bankers to put Germany back on the ropes.
And is part of that, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I know that we've read a heck of a lot, and you've done a lot of work on the German investigations of free energy technology, exotic sort of technologies,
yes.
Almost flying saucer type stuff.
Yes.
Is that also a reason to go after Hitler to get control of that material?
Yes, I think that's definitely a part of it. And certainly by, I'd say, circa 1941, 1942, British intelligence is aware enough that there is something going on inside of Nazi Germany that excels or exceeds mere research into jet aircraft and rockets. There's enough indicator that the British knew what was going on simply because of the intelligence objectives that they laid down for their agents going into Germany at the collapse of the Third Reich. They were after things like the Kohler coil, which is an invention of a German inventor that basically, I think, transduced the zero-point energy. So the British were relatively well-informed about what they wanted to go after.
I want to spend some time a little bit later about suppression of technology and
yes.
Who that benefits and who's behind it. But for right now, without getting too far ahead of us, tell me about this Chinese guy, Henry Lee, who developed this. He sort of put it all down in a formula that lays it on out.
Well, yeah, Lee, I think his name was David, actually. But
oh,
Lee,
David.
Yeah, David Lee was a Chinese mathematician that worked for the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. And he is, if we're to blame the financial meltdown on one single individual, it would have to be this guy, because he came up with what's called a Gaussian copula formula, which is a statistical formula that attempted to correlate all sorts of different financial and economic activity into one number. Okay, and we're talking here about a formula that's designed to coordinate thousands of interlocked moving parts in an economy. Now, the interesting thing to me, George, is when he came up with this formula, he completely dispensed with any sort of historical data for what he was trying to do and said, well, we can just base this all on market prices to derive the number by which we're going to rate bundles of securities and debt swaps. So in other words, he's tossed any sort of historical data right out the window. And of course, once he came up with this formula, you had the Wall Street and London banks just jump on it like, you know, for all they were worth. And they started creating not only bundles of credit swaps and default swaps, but they started creating bundles of bundles. And so they simply ended up inflating dramatically the amount of debt in circulation. And if the market, for whatever reason, for whatever historical reason, would suddenly turn, then of course that bubble would burst. And that's exactly what we see happen. Now, to me, George, the really interesting thing about this guy is that after he quit working for the Canadian Bank, Imperial Bank of Commerce, he went back to Beijing, where he assumed a position in a major Chinese corporation and government entity assessing risk, okay? So, in other words, it's looking to me suspiciously like we're dealing here with his formula with the possibility that some sort of economic warfare had been tried on for size. And with the crack-up of the European Union as a result of it, I think that possibility is even stronger.
So is he the guy, or would it fit his theory that the Chinese should go ahead and absorb all this American debt?
Well, that's another good question. I don't know. I don't think, in all honesty, from what I've seen and read the Chinese government saying lately, I don't think they're too keen on accepting worthless paper dollars. In other words, they want dollars that represent actual production. Now that, and I think that's almost the exact words that they have used. And to me, that's a very, very interesting signal, George, because if we look at China's money, the yuan, we're looking at state-issued money. In other words, there's no Rothschild, Rockefeller private bank issuing monetized debt as the Chinese currency. Their currency is debt-free. The only problem that the Chinese have is that they have deliberately in the past pegged the value of their currency unit to the dollar. So what they're signaling, I think, is very subtly, but very directly, they're signaling to the North American, Anglo-American banking elite that we want real money, not worthless monetized debt. And that is a real shot across the bow.
Well, play out that scenario then. What does it mean? Where could that go?
Well, the way I look at it, George, and I get that question a lot, and it's an excellent question, I look at the Anglo-American banksters right now as being on a worldwide defensive. They have managed for the last 60-some years to, through the International Monetary Fund and the Bank of International Settlements and some of these other institutions that they have control of, they have managed to ruin countries' economies. They have managed to project American power and kind of hide behind it. And they have made a lot of enemies. Russia certainly is not on our side. China certainly is not. The recent Japanese elections have, I think, sent shockwaves through their corridors of power. I think they're on the defensive. And I think, you know, one of the results of that posture is that they are not going to crash the only power base that they have left, namely the North American economy. They've made too many powerful enemies.
So do the Russians and Chinese look at us through this prism? Do they see us not as the American government, but rather the Wall Street government?
Absolutely. That is an excellent observation. And I really do believe that that is exactly the way they look at us, particularly in Russia. And the reason I say that is if you go back to the collapse of communism and the immediate aftermath for that particular period of time, particularly under Yeltsin's government, there was this rush to privatize Russia. And the Rothschilds, of course, tried to move in a very big way. And then along came a phenomenon called Vladimir Putin. And that trend very suddenly stopped. And the Russian government has since then been busily trying to weed out that influence within the Russian economy. And they've sent very many signals to these banksters. You know, Putin put a naval base, Russian naval base, in Venezuela, you know, with Hugo Chavez. Now, 10 years ago, George, if the Russians had tried anything like that under Bill Clinton or under Bush the First or Reagan or Carter, of course, that would have been it just never would have been permitted. So that to me is a sign of our weakened posture as well. So I don't think we have much of a or pardon me, I should say, I don't think that the Anglo-American banksters have much of an ally in Russia, no.
Again, I guess going back to this, how the Russians and Chinese see it, do they see us as too big to fail? Are our economies too interrelated with theirs for them to do something drastic and take us down?
Well, another excellent question. I don't know if they see us as too big to fail, and I have to preface my remarks that I'm guessing here. But if you look at the infrastructure of the Russian economy or the Chinese economy, or for that matter, even of the German economy, much of it is still based on heavy industry, heavy tool and die, and so on and so forth, actual manufacturing. I don't know that they look at us that way because our economy has, you know, we've shipped most of our manufacturing base overseas. So I don't know if they look at us too big to fail. I think in terms of this country and its own economic policy, we have to look at these banks and this policy of too big to fail, because if they now are in the position of owning the large chunk of American wealth that they do, I think it's time that we start thinking real seriously about some trust busting activity.
Well, I'm not sure that there's much of an appetite for really going as far as we probably need to go, but we'll come back to that. Again, staying with the Chinese. Now, if they're not following the model, I would think that they would represent a pretty major threat to these guys who've had
their way
for a long time. So what do they do? What would their plot be to take out the Chinese, start a war?
No, I don't. I really don't think that that's in the cards, and I'll tell you why. Again, you know, the war dice are very dangerous things to throw, because in throwing them, to a certain extent, you do lose the control or influence over events that you normally have. I don't think that's in the cards, because number one, taking out communist China would just be, you know, militarily enormous, if not impossible, task. And the other thing that they've got on their plate that they have to think very seriously about are the Shanghai Accords, with this rapprochement between Russia and China, and now India, it's looking like, and possibly even Japan. So I don't think that's in the cards. They're going to have to rethink their entire policy vis-a-vis the Orient, and I don't see them doing anything of an offensive nature at all.
One of the things you mentioned in the book is Babylon's banksters is sort of a protocol. One of the things on the list is that if the scenario you describe is true, that mm-hmm. it would necessarily fall to them that any such groups, you know, if they exist, this international cabal would have to extend control over other sources of power. Education, media, things of that sort.
Yes.
Talk about that for a couple of minutes. Like what?
Well, I think if we go back to ancient times and their manipulations of religion, religion was the principal creator of public opinion back in those days. And if we use that as a kind of a template now, what we see has happened in the last 100 or so years is, as these banks make loans to major media organs and outlets, they insist, as part of the collateralization of those loans, that they get stock in return, and that means that they usually end up being on the boards of directors of these media companies. So in effect, what you have is an interlock between the banks, the major corporations, and the major media, and that certainly spells an attempt to create a climate of opinion and steer opinion in a certain direction. I mean, my word, just look at how Congressman Ron Paul, when he was running for president in the last election cycle, was almost shut completely out of any real debate, and his views were not given that much play in the public corporate media.
So it's no accident either then, the consolidation of media companies?
No, none at all. None at all. To me, it's very deliberate.
And how would this manifest itself in academia?
In academia, that's a very different question. I think what you look at there and have to look at there are two different things: the sources of government grant funding on the one hand, and the source of private funding that comes from places like the Rockefeller Foundation and so on and so forth. Because what they're doing when they fund these projects is they're ensuring that scientists more or less stay on the reservation. In other words, that they do not go outside of approved models of physics or biology or genetics or what have you and start thinking outside the box. That's the way they control the climate of opinion in the sciences. Absolutely.
Well, we're certainly familiar with that from the world of UFOs. I might not drag you into that topic, though. We're talking with Joseph Farrell, author of the new book, Babylon's Banksters, talking about the alchemy of deep physics, high finance, and ancient religions. Stay with us. A lot more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.